Welcome. This is Exodus, an online Bible study with Dr. Joel S. Baden.
That's me. Excellent. I am going to start sharing my screen now, which it should be shared, and I'm going to jump right in because the topic for today is actually the smallest chunk of text we're going to be looking at, probably one that there is more to say about than almost any other, and certainly a text that I think more people are invested in than probably many of the others. So I'm going to get going right away. If you were to walk into most synagogues, or if you were standing outside some courthouses in the south of the U.S., you would probably see a depiction of the Ten Commandments. Here's two very, very different versions of them, including a politician whom I can't identify by sight gesturing. Though I'm not entirely sure that most people could successfully list all 10 of the Ten Commandments if you put a gun to their head, this is a text that has become a central symbol of both Judaism and Christianity. Despite this, and despite being seen across the board, really, as sort of the most fundamental expression of divine law, I posit that the Ten Commandments are relatively misunderstood. So what I want to do in this session is reorient ourselves toward them. And I'll start by saying, I'm not trying to undo what various religious traditions have made of them, of course. I want rather to show what I think they meant originally. And from there, we can see how their meaning has changed over the course of the history of interpretation. The goal being, as so often the case, to illustrate that the text doesn't have a stable meaning, even for something seemingly as basic as the Ten Commandments. So let me start with a brief historical point. The Bible, of course, dates the Ten Commandments in its story to Sinai and Moses. This remains the best picture of Moses and the Ten Commandments that exists. Now, scholars who don't, of course, take the narrative at face value have debated the origin of the Ten Commandments. It's long been thought that the Ten Commandments go back to before the biblical text came into being, that they were some older traditional law of ancient Israel. But that position is actually rooted in the notion that these laws are special somehow, right? Like, we already think they're special, so we say, oh, they must have been special then, right? Just as the Ten Commandments are central to us today, they must have always been central. But there actually isn't really great evidence for this. By the turn of the Common Era, there's certainly reasonable evidence that at that point they had achieved some renown. So, for example, you know, Jesus cites them in the Gospels, or cites half of them at least. As you can see here in the text from Luke, and we have reason to think that the Ten Commandments were read liturgically in Judaism around this time also. This is a wonderful picture of something that who can read. But what this is a text called the Nash Papyrus that, as you can see, comes from Egypt and is probably dated to about the first century or second century BCE. And it's a text that contains the Ten Commandments along with the Shema, right? The central text from Deuteronomy that's used in Jewish liturgy. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, is one. So there seems to be pretty good evidence that there was liturgical reading going on of the Ten Commandments, in the decades or centuries before the turn of the Common Era. But, you know, New Testament and the Nash Papyrus are centuries later than the Decalogue itself, the Ten Commandments itself, right? We're already at this point well into the world of biblical interpretation. And I want to get us back to when the Ten Commandments were first written. And though I'm not going to go into a full argument about it, I'm simply going to tell you that the Ten Commandments were first written in the 7th century BCE. That's when they were composed. And I don't think that they had any existence before then, right? They're an invention of that time. And again, I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on this because I do want to actually get into the text of the Ten Commandments themselves. But when we ask what these laws mean, we should be asking what they would have meant then. How would someone in the 7th century BCE have understood these words? And it shouldn't surprise us that that might be different from how we understand it, or even how someone in the 1st century CE understood it. Right? There's roughly 800 years between the composition of the Ten Commandments and Jesus citing them in the New Testament. That's roughly the same distance between us and the Canterbury Tales. Now, our world is not the same as Chaucer's world. And so too, the world of the New Testament isn't the same as that of ancient Israel. A line that I use frequently in teaching and love deeply is, you know, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. And this text, despite its contemporary importance, is from that foreign, distant past. And one of the keys of critical engagement with the Bible is this recognition of that space. Right? Though we, like those before us, interpret the text to speak to our own situation, we should remember that those interpretations aren't the same as what the text means or what it meant. Right? To know that the text once meant something different is to realize that our own interpretations and those that came before us are bound by their own contexts. So, although sometimes the meaning of the Ten Commandments is relatively stable across time, do not steal pretty much means do not steal, right, now and then. Others, and even I think most others, are more opaque. And so what I want to do in our time here is move relatively swiftly through the Ten Commandments and talk about what they may have meant in ancient Israel and a little bit why and how that meaning changed over time. And as we'll see, I think in large part it changed because of Christianity. So we're going to jump right into the beginning. The translations you're going to see are mine. They should be relatively familiar. I don't think there's anything too crazy going on in them. So from the top then, the first commandment is, I, Yahweh, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the slave quarters, often house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Okay. The opening statement of the Ten Commandments and the first direct sort of instruction that follows, right? The opening statement being, I am your God who brought you out of Egypt, and the instruction being no other gods. This opening is widely understood to be among the primary biblical expressions of monotheism, right? The belief in one single deity, Yahweh. And Israel's monotheism as a unique and radical phenomenon in the ancient world is like a staple of Jewish and Christian tradition. But the idea that monotheism is the essence of Israel's faith and identity is a retrojection of later beliefs into earlier texts and times. The first appearance, even in the Bible itself, of true monotheism is in the second half of the book of Isaiah, which comes from the 6th century BCE. And I think in the 7th century, when the Ten Commandments were written, such an idea, like pure monotheism, would have been essentially unheard of. In the first half of the first millennium BCE, which is the period when most of the texts of the Hebrew Bible were composed, the existence of multiple gods was universally acknowledged and accepted. Some ancient Near Eastern cultures, like Egypt and Mesopotamia, of course, had pantheons of many gods. But Israel, however, and most of the peoples in Israel's immediate vicinity were what we call monolatrous, right? They worshiped one deity, their own national god, in Israel's case, Yahweh, but didn't deny the existence of others. So the Ten Commandments begin then with the historical basis for Israel's fidelity to its god, Yahweh. I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And this is a common refrain in the Bible, but implicit here and most places it appears is a corollary. I brought you out of Egypt, so you owe me. No other god has ever done anything for Israel. Israel is beholden in loyalty and obedience exclusively to this one god, to Yahweh. And so this opening statement of the Ten Commandments isn't monotheistic. It's actually almost dependent on the recognition that there are other deities. I, Yahweh, am your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt is the answer to a question. The question is, which God are you? Why should we worship you and not any other deity? And the second part of this opening, this first real sort of law of the Ten Commandments, also functions in this monolatrous rather than monotheistic context. You shall have no other gods before me implies that one could, in fact, have other gods. So the first commandment was created originally for a community that recognized the existence of gods other than Yahweh. It's precisely because there are other gods, gods who didn't take Israel out of Egypt, that Yahweh has to align Israel's history with its obligations to him. The function of these sentences wasn't to uphold a universal monotheistic principle. Rather, it's to preserve a particular monolatrous relationship in the face of the sort of pervasive monotheism, pervasive polytheism surrounding Israel. Now, once people came over time to believe that, in fact, Yahweh was the only God and controlled everything, once you believe that, it's hard to imagine that this hasn't always been the case, right? We're monotheistic, therefore they were monotheistic. And earlier interpreters, like actually many modern ones, for whom the singularity of God was an absolute given, couldn't have imagined that their ancestors in faith didn't hold that same basic belief about the fundamental nature of the deity. And so the opening line to the Ten Commandments couldn't be about choosing among a range of available deities, but had to be about choosing to follow the one true God. I don't think that this was a conscious interpretive decision, right? I don't think they looked at this text and said, yeah, I know this text is really about worshiping one God among many, but I want it to be monotheistic. I don't think it was conscious in that way. It was simply unthinkable to people, and I think remains so for many, unthinkable that the culture that produced the core text of the monotheistic Jewish and Christian faiths, that text wasn't itself monotheistic. Right? That was inconceivable. We've inherited both the monotheism of early biblical interpreters and the understanding of the first commandment as monotheistic that comes along with it. And that's my spiel about the first commandment. We're going to go through them quickly. I have 10 commandments to get through, and it's already 8:15. Okay, next one. You shall not make for yourselves a statue of any shape that's in the heavens above or in the earth below or the waters below the earth. You shall not bow down to them. You shall not serve them because I'm a jealous God, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to deal with the back half so much. So here we have the classic statement against, and in some senses, the classic definition of idolatry in its most literal form, the worship of a physical object. But what counts as an idol? Despite the belief that this commandment says that all images are off limits, you can't make any images whatsoever. A prohibition on all images is actually hardly plausible for the 7th century context of the Ten Commandments. We often talk about Israel as being right, like an iconic, right? They didn't have images, but in fact, that's not the case. Images of the natural world abounded in ancient Israel, even, actually, perhaps especially, where they would seem to be most obviously forbidden, and that's the temple. Cherubs, pomegranates, palm trees, flowers, oxen, lions, right? The central site of Israel's worship was practically blanketed in just the sort of images that would seem to be prohibited by this commandment. So it's not the case that images per se were considered off limits. Rather, what this commandment takes aim at is images of the deity. and particularly those that come in the form of statues. And in order to understand this specific prohibition, we need to understand how God was conceptualized in ancient Israel and how gods were worshipped in Israel's cultural context. Israel's deity, Yahweh, was not the formless, ineffable, undefinable God that we imagine today. The Bible teems with expressions of descriptions of Yahweh's body, the hand of God, the mouth of God, the finger of God. We even have the back of God, right? Yahweh's described as sitting on a throne, as walking, standing, looking, hearing. Now, from a very early period, interpreters reckoned with this language by declaring it to be metaphorical. It's meant to help humans understand what would otherwise be inaccessible and incomprehensible. But those interpretations are just an attempt to shoehorn the God described in the Bible into later theological and philosophical worldviews. So Yahweh, the God of ancient Israel, was decidedly anthropomorphic, had the shape of a human. Equally at odds with modern theological sensibilities is the fact that for ancient Israelites, God wasn't invisible. God appears to a variety of biblical characters. And while it is repeatedly emphasized that seeing God is dangerous, that very fear only reinforces the claim that God can indeed be seen. What distinguished Israel from its neighboring cultures wasn't that Yahweh was formless or invisible, but rather that the body of Yahweh wasn't figuratively represented in the sanctuary. But this was unique in the ancient Near Eastern world. Gods dwelt in their sanctuaries, and visibly so, in the form of statues. Now, not all images were used in foreign worship, but almost all foreign worship used images, statues. And that's what this commandment is about. It's about not worshiping images, statues, because that's what everybody else in their context did, and not what Israel did. And if you did worship an image, right, even if you think what you're worshiping is an image of Yahweh, right, you're committing apostasy. And this is background to a conversation we'll have next time about, say, the golden calf. Moving along. You shall not, this one's going to be feel a little bit different, but I'll give you a more familiar version. You shall not employ the name of Yahweh your God for an oath in vain. For Yahweh will not release from obligation one who employs his name for an oath in vain. Now, the King James version of this third commandment reads in more familiar terms, you shall not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. And this is the verse that has been invoked by generations of parents castigating their children for exclaiming, God damn it, or stubbing their toe and saying, Jesus Christ, right? The name of God, even the word God, right, has its proper place in time and use elsewhere is forbidden, is how this commandment is often taken. Now, while the use of God's name was indeed a serious thing, even in ancient Israel, our modern understanding of this commandment is much broader than it was originally intended to be. Technical terms that are used in the Hebrew here, and terms that have been obscured in the process of translation, make clear that this commandment was originally intended to apply specifically to the formal taking of an oath. Now, an oath, then as now, was more than a mere statement of intent. It was a pledge, a promise that could not be broken without fear of consequence. The solemnity of the oath and the potential consequences for breaking it were guaranteed by the invocation of the divine name. So you'd say, I swear by Yahweh that whatever, and you have now said something significant. In fact, in one of my favorite little tidbits, right? The use of God's name in taking an oath is so ingrained in the Bible that when Yahweh swears by his own name. Right. So like this is a serious deal. And you have to understand, in a society that was largely illiterate, the spoken word held much more power than it does today. Right? Today, we require documents and signatures and notaries. Back then, an oath was as close as you could get to the modern sense of legally binding. Right? Yahweh himself is bound by his own oath. There is a modern context in which we come relatively close to this ancient sense of the power of the divine name. And ironically, it's also the closest we come to the ancient context for which this law was originally conceived. When we give testimony in court, we swear to tell the truth, so help me God. Or at least that's what they do on TV. I don't know that I've ever been asked to do it in real life. But that language, right, so help me God, we're invoking a divine punishment for breaking our word, right? Just as would a person who was taking an oath in ancient Israel. Of course, I mean, we have human laws against perjury to back that up. But the notion of swearing to tell the truth in court, so help me God, right, is attaching the divine name to a statement. So this original oath-taking context for the third commandment has never been totally lost, but it has been dramatically expanded. Right? For 7th century Israel, oaths were a serious business, right? And perhaps they were the only way to guarantee one's word. As societies grew more literate and other legally binding structures were devised and implemented, it seems rather odd for the Ten Commandments, right, the most highly valued set of divine statements in the entire Bible, to make such a big deal out of something as minor or specific as an oath or the formal context of oath taking. When you assume that the Ten Commandments must always and must have always maintained their exalted universal status, this commandment's got to be about something more than just an old-fashioned way of pledging to do something. And so it was broadened from oaths to all statements and all contexts. And to build on something I said last week, the very definition of the name of God has also expanded, right? We somehow say to people that they are like violating this commandment when they say, God damn it. But God damn it doesn't use the name of God, right? And yet it's considered to be sort of the paradigmatic example of taking the Lord's name in vain. And this goes back to, again, what I said last time. When people stop seeing the actual name of God, Yahweh, represented in their texts, and they see instead the Lord, right? The notion of the power of the divine name, God's own personal name, that all becomes obscured. And suddenly the title God becomes the same thing as the Lord's name. But when you do it, the translation as I have here, and it doesn't say, you shall not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, but say, you shall not use the name Yahweh for an oath in vain. But you see the difference there. This is a big one. It's just a big text. It's no bigger than the other other commandments, I guess. Observe the Sabbath day by sanctifying it, as Yahweh your God commanded you. 6 days you'll labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of Yahweh your God. You shall not do any work. You and no one affiliated with you. Remember, you were a slave. Etc. So I'm going to invoke one of everyone's favorite early Christian theologians, Augustine, everyone's favorite, unless you're Jewish, in good early Christian fashion. Augustine argued that although the rest of the laws of the Hebrew Bible were no longer binding, Christians were indeed still required to follow the Ten Commandments. And I'm going to read you a quote from him. He says, Who can say that Christians ought not to be observant to serve the one God with religious obedience, not to worship an idol, not to take the name of the Lord in vain, to honor one's parents, not to commit adulteries, murders, thefts, false witness, not to covet another man's wife or anything at all that belongs to another man? Right, this is Augustine saying, right, of course Christians should obey all of the laws, and then rattles off the Ten Commandments in order. All of them except the Sabbath, which is prominently missing from his list. And that's because it is the only one of the Ten Commandments that was in Augustine's time and remains today essentially specifically Jewish. In Augustine's time, and for centuries before him too, and down to the present, the Sabbath laws, like circumcision and kosher restrictions, were among the most salient and public markers of Jewish identity. And so it's no wonder that Augustine rebelled against the idea that such a stereotypically Jewish practice should be enshrined in the one set of laws that were still binding on Christians, especially when the rejection of those Jewish practices was at the heart of how early Christians sought to separate themselves from their Jewish background, their Jewish origins. Now, Judaism, of course, came to develop a remarkably thorough set of practices around the Sabbath, practices which would come to define both Judaism and the Sabbath. But in the 7th century, and indeed for most of the first millennium BCE, the Sabbath looked nothing like the later Jewish day of rest. It was actually, somewhat ironically, probably much closer to what would come to be the Christian version of the Sabbath. So I think that we generally think of the Sabbath now as observed primarily through deprivation. Here's the giant list of stuff you can't do, right? You can't cook, you can't light fires, you can't carry stuff, et cetera, et cetera. But biblical texts from the 7th century BCE and from earlier suggest that the Sabbath in Israel was in fact not primarily a day of deprivation, it was a day of celebration, it was a festival. And festival days were days devoted to God, on which, as a general rule, work wasn't done. And this was largely for practical purposes, because festivals in ancient Israel entailed sacrifice. You had to bring your offerings to the sanctuary, where you then had to eat a meal that consisted of the, you know, parts of the offerings that were given back to you to eat. They were day-long affairs. You couldn't celebrate a festival like just, you know, first thing in the morning. So enforcing a prohibition on work would have been a way to guarantee that no one could prioritize their own economic well-being over the needs of God or the sanctuary. And that's all that work meant in the context of the Sabbath. It was just the means by which one earned a living. The Sabbath was, quite simply, not a work day. It was a day set apart, which is the sort of the real meaning of the word that we translate into English as sanctify. It really just means to set apart. It was a day set apart for communal ritual obligations. It was only with the advent of rabbinic interpretation of the Bible around the turn of the Common Era, when the work prohibited on the Sabbath would come to encompass almost every element of human activity, from lighting a fire to carrying an object outside the house. But that was the understanding of the Sabbath that was known to Augustine, and that's the understanding that remains in place for observant Jews to this day. The Sabbath in Christianity would, of course, come to be a day for setting aside one's weekday occupation, a day for expanded church rituals, and for the Eucharist in particular. In other words, in Christianity, it came to look more like the Sabbath of 7th century BC Israel than it did like the Sabbath of 1st century Judaism. So Christianity's devaluation of the fourth commandment, right? Their view that we uphold all of them just as they're written, except for this one. Right? It wasn't actually a response to the biblical text. It was a response to its Jewish interpretation and implementation. And it was the Jewish interpretation and implementation of the Sabbath that actually are responsible for obscuring the original sense of the fourth commandment. Honor your father and your mother in order that your days may be long and it may go well for you on the land. We tend to understand this commandment relatively broadly, as have interpreters for ages, right? This is about respect and obedience and service, right? It's about respecting your elders, your parents. And respect for your parents is certainly a well-established value in ancient Israel, as in most every society. But I think that this commandment originally had a different and more specific kind of honor in mind. What almost all interpreters have missed, and for good reason, is that in 7th century BCE Israel, honoring one's parents entailed practices that extended beyond the parents' lifetimes. Across the ancient Near East, it was expected that the surviving children would care for and tend to the burial sites of their deceased parents and ancestors. This involved maintaining the grave, setting up a marker over the burial site, and even the offering of food and drink at the burial site for the sake of the dead. It was understood that the dead possessed ongoing power and required ongoing attention. They were believed to be protective presences, sometimes thought to be capable of influencing fertility. And in order to guarantee the continued blessings of the deceased, the living were obligated to ensure their post-mortem comfort. And as in life, this meant providing them with a secure space in which to dwell and the nourishment needed to sustain them. Now, later readers of the Ten Commandments were, and largely remain, entirely ignorant of this common ancient Israelite belief and practice. And again, for good reason, even in the biblical period, these practices had already begun to disappear. We can say not entirely, a lot of that remains with us today, right? We still care for the burial places of our ancestors. But as it sort of, as that notion fell away and those practices fell away, the meaning of the fifth commandment changed in ways that, I think we could probably at this point describe as relatively typical. What was once imagined as sort of ritual or even tangible transformed into ethical and moral. And so what has been obscured and really entirely lost basically was this centuries-old belief in the need to care in really direct ways for one's deceased ancestors. I think that's what this passage was originally about. And I think that to read it that way explains the fact that it says, in order that your days may be long and it may go well for you on the land. Why should honoring your parents have anything more to do with it going well for you in the land than any of the other commandments? It's because your parents are buried there, right? You preserving them in that land guarantees your right to the land, right? And guarantees that your ancestors will continue to protect you in the land that was theirs. Okay. Shall not murder. This is probably the best known of the Ten Commandments. My guess is that if you ask people to list the Ten Commandments, this is the first one that comes out of people's mouths. But most people know this sixth commandment from the King James Version, which says, thou shalt not kill. But English distinguishes between the words murder and kill, and so too does biblical Hebrew. And what this commandment says in the Hebrew is decidedly murder, not kill. The history of the switch from murder to kill goes back well beyond the King James, back to Jerome in the 4th century CE, who translated the Bible from Hebrew into Latin, what's known as the Vulgate. Hebrew says murder, uses a specific and actually reasonably rare term. And the Septuagint, the Greek translation from the 3rd century BCE, also uses a specific word for murder. But Jerome used a pretty broad word in Latin, one that basically means kill, which really wasn't an interpretive choice on Jerome's part, more a function of Latin, which in Jerome's time at least, didn't really distinguish between murder and kill in a lexical sense. Right? The one word was used for both in both contexts equally. But because Jerome used this broader term, right, for the wide swath of Western Christianity that took Jerome's Vulgate as the primary biblical text, including the King James, distinctions that were present in the Hebrew of the sixth commandment between murder and kill were obscured. And the ambiguity of the traditional Latin and then traditional English text has resulted in this wide variety of practical interpretations of the sixth commandment. The overlap between those who claim to live according to biblical principles and those who support the death penalty in America, for example, is relatively well established, I think. Martin Luther, in explaining this commandment, distinguished between individual killing, which is forbidden, and state-sanctioned killing, which is permitted, right? As if this law is about individuals not being allowed to take decisions about life or death into their own hands. Which probably isn't far off from the original intent of the Ten Commandments, even though when Luther translated the text into German, he also used the word kill rather than murder. In Catholicism, the Sixth Commandment is invoked to explain the principle of the sanctity of life, which obviously undergirds Catholic opposition to abortion and the death penalty together. But in Catholicism, that doesn't extend to killing in the context of a military conflict, which is permitted under the doctrine of just war. And on the very furthest other end of the spectrum, there are, for those who have been called absolute pacifists, the sixth commandment is the foundational principle. And the common rendering of it as thou shalt not kill is actually essential. Right? The philosopher Bertrand Russell, who signed on to the absolute pacifism, said, the commandment doesn't say you must only kill bad people, or only kill by due process of law, or only kill in defense of your country. It says simply and unequivocally, thou shalt not kill. Except that it doesn't. So, you know, in short, the most famous commandment of them all may also be, at least in its common rendering, one of the least well-defined, with an incredibly wide range of interpretations and applications. And ironically, it's that way only because translations from the Hebrew removed the specificity that existed and remains in the original Hebrew text. You shall not commit adultery. This seventh commandment brings with it a slew of early and some modern Christian claims regarding the propriety of marriage, monogamy, fidelity, and sexual activity more generally. You know, this was mostly seen as clearly an ethical failure. And, you know, in practical terms, this commandment is pretty straightforward. There's no dispute about what's intended here or what's condemned. There's no text in the Bible that suggests that adultery is maybe not so bad after all. But this is not a statement about the moral virtues of monogamy, right? Ancient Israelite society, not only in the 7th century BCE, but for centuries thereafter, was perfectly comfortable with polygamy. Nor was there any significant stigma against non-procreative sex outside of marriage. There's no laws against visiting a prostitute in the Bible, for example. What ancient Israel was uncomfortable with, mostly, was potential confusion around issues of paternity and inheritance. And this is what the prohibition on adultery, like the rest of the sexual laws in the Bible, was really about. You know, land, of course, was passed down from father to son, and a whole slew of customs and practices existed to ensure that regardless of extenuating circumstances, the line of inheritance would be preserved within the family and clan. Without modern paternity tests, there was no way to definitively determine legitimate parenthood. So adultery was actually a threat to more than just the moral fabric of Israelite culture. It threatened to undermine the entire familial and economic structure of society. And so it needed to be explicitly prohibited. Now, for later interpreters, especially those in urban settings, the entire conceptual cluster of land, inheritance, and kinship, which is so central to ancient Israel, was basically unfamiliar. Right? In Greco-Roman high society, the time of the New Testament and the rise of Christianity, it was not at all uncommon for elites to adopt beloved adult acquaintances to be their heirs. So once the seventh commandment is sort of untethered from the mundane economic practicalities of ancient Israel, again, it floats up into these higher realms of pure ethics and morality, where it basically has remained ever since. This won't be quick. You shall not steal means you shall not steal. That's all I'm going to say about it. There's nothing else. You shall not testify against your neighbor with false witness. Right? This is obviously more commonly in the phrase, you shall not bear false witness, which has become a fancy biblical term for tell a lie. Right? You shall not bear false witness means you shall not tell a lie. And this commandment is frequently cited as the biblical basis for telling the truth. Now, while lying is certainly frowned upon in the Hebrew Bible, what is prohibited here is the more specific offense of perjury. And the key word in the ninth commandment is witness. In the Bible, to witness was not just to see something, as we often use the word today, but to say something, and to do so publicly. Every act of witnessing in the Bible, whether it's the creation of a monument to a treaty or the formal declaration of one's observations in a court of law, every witnessing is a public act. It was meant for public consumption. The equivalent term in Greek also has this public component, right? Martus, witness, was the root of martyr, which is one who bore witness. And Christian martyrs, like the Jewish martyrs before them, were the ones who publicly affirmed their religious faith upon risk of death. And for many contemporary Christians, witness still carries this sense of an open declaration of faith. So just as witness meant something more specific than simply speak, so too false witness meant something more specific than lie. Biblical Hebrew has a separate word that's used explicitly for private deception. Characters in the Bible say to each other, "Why did you deceive me?" Right? That's private deception. It's also a social violation, but being private, by its very nature, it doesn't fall into the category of false witness. And we don't find any laws about it or potential punishments for it. Why? Because biblical law is very clear that in order for a crime to be punished, ironically, there must be witnesses. So as with modern day perjury laws, it's for this reason that false witness was considered such a grave crime. Lies can have a variety of negative consequences, but bearing false witness in a formal judicial setting can result in another person's financial loss or imprisonment or physical injury or death. And until relatively recently, before the advent of forensic sciences, witness testimony was the primary and often sole form of evidence on which a case could be decided. So we have a whole slew of biblical laws that attempt to ensure that witnesses neither lie nor collude. The shift in interpretation of this commandment from public courtroom testimony to lying more generally actually began reasonably early. The third century CE, the church father Origen declared amazingly that one was equally liable for bearing false witness in one's heart, right? That is to take the act as far out of the public eye as really you can imagine. Augustine used this law to argue that there's no circumstance in which a believing Christian should tell a lie. Now, again, the expansion of the meaning here is not at all due to some change of social norms. Perjury has always been condemned. But it's another example of, I think, a largely Christian desire for the Ten Commandments to stand as the primary statement of the divine will, to be natural law, ethics, ethical and moral standards. False witness in the technical legal sense is wrong, of course. But surely something more broadly applicable must have been intended in this great declaration of God's rules for how we should live our lives. Last one. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Probably shouldn't cover her either. And you shall not desire the house of your neighbor or any of the other stuff. This commandment covers lots of Catholic concepts of sin, carnal thoughts, lust, envy, greed. Probably not so far off from what the original intent of the text was. This legislates inner thoughts and desires. In that, it feels sort of like an outlier in the Ten Commandments, right? It certainly seems different from a broad injunction like don't steal. But this is a pretty good conclusion to the Ten Commandments, right? It appeals to internal thought processes. And in that, it goes right back to the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, which is also about thought rather than action. In addition, this commandment is something of a summation of all of the socially oriented commandments that immediately precede it. Adultery, thefts, even potentially murder and false witness, all might be based on the coveting of what others have. They're actions that tear the social fabric. And so the Ten Commandments forbids them explicitly. But the text goes further and forbids the desire that drives such crimes against one's neighbor. Now, some readers encounter the final lines here and wonder how such laws could ever be enforced. But actually, in this commandment clarifies an aspect of the Ten Commandments that's been true all along. These aren't laws in the modern sense, where someone who breaks them can be charged with a crime and tried and punished. Hebrew Bible's got lots of references to trials and judgments and confessions and punishments. And they all have to do with actions. That's why we have the centrality of witness testimony, as we've already talked about. The 7th century author of the Ten Commandments could not have imagined that a person's thoughts and desires would be policed and punished by the state or by religion. Nor would an ancient world have recognized the concept of, like, cardinal sins for which one would be denied entry into heaven or require penance. The Ten Commandments aren't a list of the ways that individuals can assure themselves eternal life. That concept belongs to Christianity, rather than to the ancient world from which the text emerged. Okay, I see the time, and so a final, I'm going to go back to this slide just for fun, a final and relatively important point about the Ten Commandments that I think this slide is illustrative of. As most of us are probably aware, a central element of early Christianity, as I said earlier, was the untethering of faith from observance of the laws of Moses. But the one major exception was the Ten Commandments, which, because Jesus quotes them, and because they are the only laws spoken directly by God and not given through Moses, these are the laws that were understood by early Christianity to remain in force of all of the laws of the Old Testament, of the Hebrew Bible. And this is why, in large part, the Ten Commandments became a symbol of Christianity, as in the case of the courthouses, despite being a decidedly Israelite and Jewish text. But Christianity's interest in the Ten Commandments had an effect on Judaism as well. Judaism, around the time of Jesus, recognized the importance of the Ten Commandments. Jesus, after all, was Jewish. That's a separate Yale Bible study. But when Christianity laid claim to the Ten Commandments, Judaism actually backed off of them. They were once read in regular daily Jewish liturgy, but that practice stopped. We actually have rabbinic texts from the first couple of centuries of the Common Era that say we no longer read the Ten Commandments in our daily liturgy so as not to appear to affirm the views of the heretics. The heretics are Christians. So why did Jews stop reading it? Because reading the Ten Commandments regularly in liturgical practice, the Ten Commandments, but not all the other laws, right, appeared as if it were affirming the Christian position that these laws were more important. In Judaism, there are 613 commandments in the Torah, all of them equally important. And these 10 are certainly lovely, but they're no better than the rest. And if Christianity claims that they are, then Judaism has to assert that they're not. And so the prominence of the Ten Commandments in Judaism was actually downplayed, right? They were downgraded from, we recognize that these are actually special in a certain way, to we absolutely do not affirm that these are special in any way. And in that, Judaism effectively ceded the Ten Commandments to Christianity. I could go on Ten Commandments forever. I love this text. There's so much to be said about it, but I am going to stop and allow some time for discussion.
Thank you for joining us. Please join us next week for session 4.